I went out after I realized you were coming in. I got out my original copy of Mouse, and because I wanted to refresh my memory, because it's been
86 to now.
86, so that's 5 years ago. It's a long time.
Well, this whole book, it's finally finished. It's 13 years. It's like, I don't know what I do next, but this is like, this project had its bar mitzvah finally. You know, it's over. From 86 to 91. Well, actually, from 78 to 91 is the whole project.
But there are, wait a minute, it's not quite finished. There are a few more things I'd like to know about your father. Well, let's,
what it is, in 78 I started the project and it had an outline and I achieved the end of the outline somehow. So there are other things that I'll talk about in other formats, but maybe not with mouse heads and maybe not.
Well, you know, there's a lot about what your father did after he arrived in the United States.
But yeah, the main ones though got seeded. You know,
yeah,
somewhere in the parts
passing
of it, like there's a reference to, he worked at this job, he lived in this city, and then he came to America, and, you know, like, just enough so you can kind of posit it. What it is his life after it re-achieves this abnormal normalcy is not part of the story. The story is like the radiation from this horrible set of events that he and my mother lived through, and how that affected me, how that affected our relationship, and how it affected him after. You get to know sort of how it affected him after, just by being in the room with him and me talking. So I feel that, like, at least implicitly, everything got covered from, and anything else is some other story, you know, like maybe done with people even, God knows. I'd have to learn how to draw people instead of animals. But
well, when Mouse first came out, of course, it was published in excerpts in your magazine Raw. I think it startled a lot of people because they didn't know if it was a cartoon, a comic, was it fiction, was it biography, but I think it shaped down pretty well to be biography.
I think so, although I still keep seeing everybody get confused. The Sunday Times Book Review talks about it as fable and fiction, whereas the Daily Reviewer talks about it as memoir. So I exist somewhere in the cracks between various attempts at classification. And I tend to think of it as nonfiction, autobiography slash biography slash mice.
Well, it's really unique. I mean, there's nothing quite like it at all. Let's go back to the original concept of Mouse. You began drawing almost therapeutically, I think.
Kind of therapeutically, although I wouldn't have defined it that way, because a lot of the therapy is A, more expensive, and B, more efficient, maybe. You know, this is something else. It's like trying to understand something, but not necessarily aiming at catharsis. Just wanting to, what the heck did my parents go through? I didn't understand it. I'd hear these like weird shards of anecdote while I was growing up, but I wouldn't have a clear sense of where was this? What nightmare world were they living on? I just didn't understand. And I suppose this was my attempt at reconstruction, to figure out by inhabiting it in a safe way in pictures what it is that my parents went through.
The portrait of your father, of course, is especially compelling. Here is a very vulnerable man, a very weak man in many respects, and yet also a hero, a man, a survivor who fought and struggled to survive and succeeded. It's really a unique story in many respects, and yet, I mean, there's so many people who died, and yet he survived.
But that's because the war ended in 44/5 rather than 45/6. You know, if the war had been allowed to unravel further, more of the survivors would have not survived, and that could have included my father. What's amazing is that he was very present-minded and really was able to, like, look around and take advantage of whatever slight openings or situations were around. And he was very proud of the fact they wanted a guy to fix roofs, he was a roof fixer. They wanted a shoemaker, he was a shoemaker. Whatever it was that they needed, he would try to be that to survive. On the other hand, the predominant and overwhelming factor is that he could have just been wiped out at any second just because of the way that killing machine worked. So and as is pointed out in the book, there are other people who survived, including my mother, at least till 1968 when she killed herself. She survived without having any of those qualities. She had other qualities. But there were a lot of different attributes and mixes. This was my father's. And in some ways, certain traits of his that existed before the war were exacerbated and were useful, functional for him in extremis, and then after the war were less useful and actually made him a difficult person.
Well, I have a great many members of my own family who did things like your father did. You know. I remember my grandmother had a huge ball of string, and she had a label on it, string too short to use. You wonder why she kept a ball of string too short to use. But actually, the
I could let her have my file of letters that I really should answer but won't, which is one of the files in the cabinet.
But in a way, your father's vulnerabilities are universal.
Yeah.
You may not think so, being
no,
the son.
But you know,
are.
I thought, actually, aside from that, that one's relationship with one's parents is universal, and that therefore even people who have no direct reason to take access, although I believe they do, no direct reason to take access into thinking about the Holocaust or what happened there. Like some people say, well, that's this Jewish tribe's story. It's not our story. And I find that a problem, but even those people have parents, and as a result, a number of them have been able to find their way into this by just trying to deal with the father-son relationship that's in the story. That those difficulties may not be as exacerbated in every family, but they exist.
Well, there's a stereotype, of course, of the Jewish mother who preys on her children's guilt. Well, I come from a WASP family. I tell you, they're no different. My mother preyed on my guilt every day that I talked to her. I mean, it's absolutely no different.
Yeah.
They're all like that. And mothers are like that. And fathers are a little different than mothers. I don't know. Mothers do have a tendency to prey on guilt. Fathers don't. I don't. As a rule, they all seem a little different.
Yeah, but they all have this one dynamic of you're always, as the son, trying to measure up what it is to be a man against your father, one way or another. And that sets up a set of psychological tensions that has to be dealt with.
Oh, yeah, there's that feeling of subtle contempt that you're not doing as well as you're supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, well, actually, there's this long sequence in the second book, or it's not long, it feels long to me. There was 6 or 8 pages in the second book of what to do now that Mao's One had come out and was successful, because I was ready for anything but success. I was ready just to keep going in obscurity till I got this thing finished. It was about 8 months of kind of being in a funk and talking and going to see a shrink and working this out so I could continue, and then wanted to include at least a synopsis of what I've gone through as part of the book, so that's in there now. And I know that, like, right now I'm feeling great. Like, I said I would do something 13 years ago. The reason I took it on was that it was totally beyond me. I couldn't figure out how you make this into a comic strip, but I just knew that that was, like, my Everest. That was what I was going to climb and try to accomplish, and now it's done. That's really terrific. I'm happy I got it together on one level or another.
It must give you an enormous sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, but I realize I'm flying, like, really, you know, I'm soaring because, like, it's over, and I still have, like, that momentum of having done it. But somewhere along the line, I'm going to be crashing into this blank piece of paper, you know.
I would assume this is what usually happens. After the excitement, you'll dive into a state of depression somewhere along the line.
Exactly. Now what?
It always happens.
Yeah. So it's part of the system. It's part of the job description.
But it's nice to be wanted.
Yes, it is. It's true. It is nice. But on the other hand, I've seen people, like, having problems with both ends of it, and I've seen people succeeding through both ends of it, including some of the cartoonists in Raw just astound me. Like, there's an artist named Kim Deitch who's doing beautiful work. He's pushing 50 now. Never had any, like, real outside world interest except for this very specialized world of people who just like these strange comics. And he's doing the best work of his career, and he's logging 18-hour days usually working on this stuff without any real hope that the world is just about to look over his shoulder and grab onto it. So we published a 45-page story he just did that's one of the best things he's ever done. Raw itself, as you said, oh, is Raw still coming out? You know, it's not this high-profile thing, but it does allow people to fulfill themselves by getting their work done.
Now, I want to clarify that. I do have a number of the later issues of Raw, but you said it's an annual, and it's been so long since I've seen the last issue.
Well, there's one that came out in May. It's been one a year
since. Well, that one I don't think.
I'll send it to you after I get back to the house.
Yeah. I mean, I do have a number of copies of Raw, it's true, I've lost touch a little bit. People who care are going to find it, and they're going to find it no matter where it's been.
I suppose. I mean, at this point, it is about 35,000 copies, so it's not invisible.
No.
And Penguin is doing it, so it's around in bookshops. And on the other hand, finding an audience for comics is a peculiar thing. Like, Mao's has been blessed or cursed with its subject matter, and that allows audiences who would never approach a comic ever, because they have, like, this stereotypal notion of what a comic has to be, to now find this, because the subject matter was enough to put it across. And yet the problem is that the people who ordinarily gravitate toward comics aren't the people who necessarily gravitate toward comics that are pushing at the edges and trying to find something more inside a medium that seems to have already been defined and is, if anything, wide open.
Well, I know I read the review, and you got a front-page review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. I mean, that's extraordinary, that a graphic novel like this, probably the first time a graphic novel has ever been on the front page of the New York Times
blew,
Sunday
blew
Book.
My mind, but it even starts by saying, this is not a comic. I think that's the first sentence. And yet there are these balloons and little cartoonish drawings underneath that indicate otherwise. But in amazingly enough, bit by bit, you know, you're saying something about Mailer. I'd heard through a friend something that Mailer had said, which is he was pessimistic about the future of the novel. He thought that in the future, novelists would be like poets, like they just publish for other novelists, you know, that the world isn't attending to novels anymore the way they had. And I feel that, in a sense, if novels become like poems, then comics can become like novels, you know, that we're sort of business. As mass media becomes more and more mass, then a literate audience is a more kind of self-selected group, and it's probably a smaller and smaller one.
I don't know if Mailer said that or not, but if he did say it, it's not true. And the reason it's not true is that people love stories. They love to be told stories, and they like to tell stories.
But then
whenever people have this urge and impulse, you're going to find novels.
Maybe, except that the primary mode for telling stories now is no longer the novel. It was in the 19th century.
Well, and before that, there were television.
Exactly.
No laser disc.
Exactly. It's now VCRs and.
Well, the novel has to compete. That's true. Mm-hmm. But the novel does things that a video can't do. I mean, a motion picture version of a complex story cannot get into the psyche and the heart in the way that a novel can.
Well, every medium has its possibilities. That's what's amazing. But like, look at like radio drama. It was like a great medium in the 30s and 40s, and it could do things that nobody else could do any other way. And it's a wonderful, rich medium. And now it's just, if it's present at all, it's really vestigial. You know, so that what happens is the impulse for story is always present, but what the delivery system is. You know, in 5 years I'll have these smokeless cigarettes or something where it won't be a problem for me to go around outside of my studio. The delivery system may change. And there are things that are wonderful in novels that can't be done any other way. There are things that are amazing in comics that can't be done any other way. And yet I think the broad audience is probably, unfortunately, the audience that will take their story with the least amount of having to go and meet it. You know, like what I ask for of a work actually is often that it asks something of me to come and try to find my way in. But what I find is like the more normal way to get a story is like you're dead at the end of a day's work, you push that button, and then something's coming at you. And actually what's coming at you is this postmodern reality, because you have your zap button and get bits of stories, and maybe it creates this new nonlinear kind of narrative that gets you from exercise machine ads to home shopping centers to a bit of a 1940s movie to a bit of the world news, and maybe that's the new kind of narrative.
Well, a novel does demand more of you than turning on a sitcom on mm-hmm. Channel 2, that's true. But, and the market, if you want to call it that, is a little chaotic right now. There are so many alternatives, and there are going to be more. Mm-hmm. I see Sony is coming out with a book on a little, I guess it's like a little computer, and you can load it. You can load a disc or something in there, and you have the book in there. I don't know how good this is for fiction, but can you imagine all of the possibilities in terms of just information to punch up what you want? And I've seen pictures of it. It's about $500. And take it with you.
Not to mention
the little Sonys that they give you on airlines, you know, then you put tape in there and look at it right in your seat. You don't have to look at a big screen and share the big screen. You have your own.
Well, what enchants me about novels and about comics is that they're made with such economical means. Like anybody with a yellow pad and some sharp writing stump can finally get a novel made. And comics similarly can be done with very, very simple tools. In fact, like I was just using a fountain pen and typing paper for mine this time, although other strips I've done have had more elaborate media.
Mouse was typing paper?
Yeah. See, I wanted to feel like I was writing rather than like I was drawing. In other things I've done, usually like a cartoonist works real big, like 15 by 20 inches might be a typical dimension that comes down to 8.5 by 11, because that way you minimize your mistakes. So I wanted to work small, first of all, so typing paper was adequate in terms of its scale, because I wanted the intimacy of comics to come across. And I didn't want to minimize my mistakes. I wanted to maximize them. I wanted them to be present. So those drawings are 1 inch by 1 inch or 2 inches by 2 inches.
So much harder to do on small scale.
Well, except that what it does is it does eliminate the bull, because you have no room to do decoration. Anything you're drawing that small is there because it has to be there.
Each one was on a page of type.
Of 8.5 by 11, and then the image area is about 6 by 9 or something. And then each panel is about 2 inches by 2 inches or thereabouts. So part of that was I wanted the line that I make to be the line that you see. And I wanted to do it in such a way that I was a writer. So I bought all my stuff in a stationery store instead of the art supply store across the street, because that way I could feel like I was being pushed forward in this project by the word, because this was a story propelled by my father's deposition, in a sense, you know. So my responsibility was to find ways to interpret and offer what he was saying into that tape recorder or into my notebook when I was taking notes. Other comics I've done were propelled by a burning image inside my head that I had to find a way to expand into multiple images. But here, I felt if I used typing paper, liquid paper, typing correction fluid, and stationery supplies, I'd be feeling one step closer to writing.
You have your original manuscript.
Yeah, in fact, it's going to be on display at the Museum of Modern Art in December.
I was going to say that the original manuscript should have tremendous value as a piece of art.
Well, what will happen now is in December, I think 17th or 18th, the project room at the MoMA is going to be devoted to making Mouse. And what I did was, after a certain point, although it was on typing paper, I sort of just consumed lots of it. You know, there are lots and lots and lots of pictures. And at a certain point, I started using bits of tracing paper, other scraps, my notebooks. So any given page of Mouse might have generated like 40 or 50 sheets of paper. And at a certain point, certainly for all of book two, I saved it all indiscriminately. Like, I figured, I like some of these rough sketches, and maybe I'll just keep it. So I throw it in a box. And then about a month ago, after I finished the book and before I had to go out on tour, I did this thing that I call my Mouse audit. In order to get ready for the show, I had to say, this box looks like it might be from chapter 3, maybe page 27, yep. And then I made these little envelopes with all of the scraps from each page. And so a lot of the preliminary drawings, as well as the finished art, will be part of the MoMA show.
I was looking at the press kit. You're going on a tour, right?
Oh, I'm in the middle of it. This is New York is no longer my home. This is just a stop for
I was looking at this. What's first with the original Mouse? I don't think you had quite the.
It was a smaller tour, but there was a book tour as well, because Mouse first time around, and that's why it was so disorienting when I got back to having to continue the book, because essentially I was put on one of these ticker tape parades. And except after everybody cleaned up the rubble around the parade, I had to go back to work and finish a book that was just in the middle. But that was a fairly extensive tour, and this one's even more extensive. It's
sometime you were down in Washington.
Yeah, that's tomorrow.
Well, that's tomorrow.
And I just came back from Chicago yesterday, and I was in San Francisco 2 days before that. And
are you having fun?
Yes and no. One of the big problems for me, this isn't stuff you're going to want for your tape, but one of the big problems for me is
90%
this.
Of it is not what
I know this comes down to 2 minutes or something, but the smoking has been an enormous problem for me, because I have to negotiate my way through about 8 different situations every day. And I find that this kind of situation of having to like abstract myself from my work and become the Cliff's Notes for Mouse, the talking, walking, touring Cliff Notes for the book, just makes me nervous. And so that when I first started the tour in 86, I guess, or 87, for the first Mouse book, I'd been not smoking for a year and a half, and I was back smoking heavily by the end of it, and I haven't been able to stop since. And now when I'm on tour, every place there's this argument, like, can we find some way to do this, because I'll be a lot more comfortable. The most recent result was in San Francisco at an NPR station, where I actually did an interview with this woman in the men's room, because it was the only place we could set up that smoking was allowed in.
Well, I know here, we're not allowed to smoke in this room, but this is a Saturday. There's nobody here.
Uh-huh.
We have had people on our staff, believe it or not, who have been suspended without mm-hmm. pay for smoking in the newsroom or in the elevators. You can't smoke. So they set aside that one room. But
the other side of it,
you do want to stop, don't you?
No. I mean, I stopped. I didn't like it.
Well, it's difficult. But, you know, here we have in Mouse gripping scenes of mass murder. The cigarette companies are guilty of mass murder, and in a way almost worse than the Germans.
Well,
the Germans did it out of ignorance and fear and superstition. The Liggett and Myers, they're doing it out of greed. I don't know how many millions and millions of people they have killed.
Greed was operative in Nazi Germany as well. I mean, these corporations got very rich on the slave labor of Jews who were used for 3 months and then put on a scrap heap.
The manufacturers of cigarettes should be brought up on charges of murder. That's what they're killing us.
I suppose I have an image in my Mein Kampf section.
Of what?
In the Mein Kampf section, yeah. The part that didn't work into the book, of a panel that looks like a crematorium chimney and another panel of a cigarette, you know? And so I understand the problems. On the other hand, when if I could go back in time and never have started, sure, I would do that. But at this point, the year and a half where I wasn't smoking was probably if it doesn't make you live longer, it makes you feel like you're living longer. That year and a half was the hardest I remember.
It is a horrible addiction. And I smoked heavily. I was a three-pack-a-day person.
Huh. It's a terrible addiction. What about people who take cocaine and heroin and crack? Try to get that out of the system.
Usually they become alcoholic smokers when they kick their illegal addictions. Well, you know, Sartre said this thing that really rang true. It wasn't hard to give up cigarettes. It was hard to give up the idea of oneself as a smoker. Because actually, physiologically, you get this nicotine out of your system in about 2 weeks. Like you can use those Nicorette gums or anything like that. That's not the problem. The problem is that changing your behavior. And what made it so difficult for me is my way of working on Mao's was I'd work on any comic, and then I'd light up and look at what I did. And that was the trigger for stop being in right brain, move to left brain. Like, in other words, like start editing, take a look at what you're doing and try to assess where you've gone and where you have to go. And the method, just over a period of decades, I guess, just meant sit back and light up and usually let most of the cigarette go out unsmoked, but nevertheless have it lit and puff on it. And not being able to do it meant, okay, draw, shift mode, light up a cigarette. No, don't light up a cigarette. Don't light up a cigarette. Think about anything but cigarettes, Art. And then by the time I went through that conversation and got back to the strip, it was like it had moved like 50 miles away from me. And so I was having a terrible time working for that period. And so I'm trying to make peace with the fact that, like, someday I may have to kick this, but I'm not ready now.
You're going to have to do it. Yeah. You do know that statistically a cigarette smoker loses 10 or 15 years from his life.
Yeah, but I don't believe it. I think that people tend to believe in their own immortality until they're up against it, and that's a sad, true thing. Even true for people who lived in ghettos and didn't, like, in Europe and didn't fight back. The other part of the question when you asked me about the tour, there's one part that's really amazing, which is that, as with all writers, I mean, writing on a word processor or making it in pictures, it's a very kind of isolating process. I've been doing all these book signings and lectures and stuff. The realization that what I was doing is somehow really important to people, like this book has obviously been significant for the people that arrived and there were large audiences, that was like really a knockout. I must say that was kind of a rush. The first time, I suppose if I look back, some of that was happening when the first book came out, but I was really not receptive to it. I was like, I'm here, but I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I want to be back trying to figure it out. And like that kind of kept me from being present at the... in some deeper way at the signings or at the lectures. And now I guess I'm there because I'm not anywhere else, and it's an amazing thing. Like finding out that I was at UC Santa Cruz and gave a lecture, Mao's is in the core curriculum. Everybody who goes through that school reads Mao's. And that was like an overwhelming thing for me. I just couldn't understand it. In some ways, I had a tinge of worry because I remember not being able to read Dickens for decades because of having to read it in school and high school.